The last time I spoke, I had to stand on my toes. I'm really delighted that this is a more reasonable-sized podium, and I'm really delighted to be here. I have been in electronic resources for my entire professional library career, which is almost 9 years. And I'm assuming that most of you also are working in academic libraries, in electronic resources. You either do licensing or you are frustrated by people who aren't getting it done. Well, one of my responsibilities at the main library at UNC Chapel Hill is to negotiate the licenses. We have a couple of hundred licenses now. Not all of them were ones that I negotiated. They started out, of course, as CD-ROM licenses. They have developed into some very elaborate consortial long-term multi-year deals, as you're all familiar. I'm going to be talking a little bit about how CERU came about. Let's see. Yes, that works for it. But I would invite you to, if you don't already have a handout, to pick one up because that actually has the CERU document on it. And the introduction to CERU, which is sort of putting it in context, and also guidelines for using CERU, and they are on the chairs back there. I think there should be enough for this group. It's always a little risky to invite your audience to get a handout because that means you'll be looking at it and reading it. Well, I'm trying to wow you with my presentation. But since I don't think I could even begin to follow Nancy Pearl, it's probably safe to let you leaf through the handouts now. Do know that that's there in the packet. I won't be going over the understanding point by point. I'll just be referencing it, and I do think it's worth reading. I will confess that I hadn't read it in a couple of months after having been very involved in its development. And I was very impressed with it. I hope you are as well. CERU stands for, of course, the Shared E-Resources Understanding. And its basic premise is that libraries and publishers would forego a license, a formal contract, and rely on copyright law. And what CERU essentially does is provide some of the context and understandings that don't appear in copyright law. What CERU is not, I want to emphasize, is a license agreement. It is not a license of adhesion, a contract of adhesion. It is not terms of use. We encourage publishers not to take it and make it a click-through. It is simply a supplement to copyright law. One of the reasons there is a need for CERU, of course, is that license agreements and contracts require so much time and effort, and that's primarily because a publisher's license can be unique to the publisher. There are basic similarities between contracts, but every license has the opportunity to be entirely unique. Libraries, and I'm assuming we're all librarians. Are there any publishers here by any chance? Dang, that's too bad. But libraries, of course, and I expect this is your experience, once we have a license in hand, a whole set of policies and procedures are put into place, like it or not, that we have to go through in order to conform to our university, our library, and frequently for those of us who are supported by the state policies, conditioning contracts of their agents. One other point about CERU, it is not intended or expected, although it would be a very nice planet if that happened, CERU is not expected to substitute for every license that we have. But for those publishers and libraries that can rely on copyright law, CERU is hopefully a very good way to set out the expectations for both parties. And these, I expect, are fairly familiar to you. What problems does CERU solve for libraries? large backlogs of licenses, especially from the smaller publishers that may have one or two titles. This is a little risky, but how many of you do have backlogs of licenses? Not too many. You're all doing far better than I am. I managed to keep up with current requests, but as I look back over my subscriptions, and UNC is a large research library, we have just under now 10,000 print subscriptions. So we still have a lot of print. And I look at, from my vendors, my subscription agents' reports, I look at the subscriptions that we have in print that we could have online, that are offered online, but that we don't have a license for or other arrangements to view these particular subscriptions. And the last count was 300. I was dismayed. Now, not all of those publishers will require a license, but how would you find out until you go to each and every one of them? There is an opportunity here for subscription agents to step in, but my experience is that the publishers will have the most current information about whether they offer a license or not. That barrier alone prevents me from moving forward on some of these society publications, small presses, and in many cases, those are exactly the titles that are core to their particular niche, their field. And to deny them the ability to be viewed online, which is, frankly, where most of our researchers, faculty even, and certainly undergraduates go to find materials, puts them at a disadvantage. And I think these are precisely the publishers that libraries want to support to see succeed. And putting them online certainly gives them that advantage. For my library, staffing is another problem. I am the only librarian who negotiates the licenses, and I feel like, let's see, something like this, the small end of a very large funnel. I am a bottleneck, I hate to admit it, but there just isn't enough time in my day to get through all the licenses. We are looking at expanding the number of people who do licenses by doubling them, but I think even that is still, it's very hard to scale up the number of staff that process licenses. For publishers, and I have this from my publisher friends with whom I worked on Seru, it's very expensive if you're a small publisher to hire a lawyer to craft the initial license. Talking to Zach Rolnick of Now Publishing, it cost him about $10,000 to get a license worked out. And usually these lawyers aren't publishing specialists. They're not familiar with the publishing world. So what you get is sort of a basic contract with a lot of contract boilerplate that may or may not be appropriate to your particular situation. Not only is it expensive to hire a lawyer initially, but if you have questions about particular negotiation or revisions that libraries may request, you may want to go back to the lawyer to check with them, and then that's another expense. And, of course, small publishers often work on a shoestring. There may be one or two staff members for the entire publishing effort, figuring out how to negotiate the license with libraries who come back to you with their particular policies, their particular boilerplates, what they can and can't accept, what they have to have in. That's another cost center for publishers. Zach also said that he has a backlog of these license negotiations, even though he's extremely organized, really pretty much on top of things. It delays access to his titles by about a month, he estimated. And I say to that, if only. How does Seru solve these problems? Essentially, it would eliminate the need for a lawyer, eliminate the need to invoke library and university and or state licensing policies, and the extra staffing time required to process the license. It also removes barriers to access by standardizing the expectations, streamlining the whole process, and opening the door, I hope, to subscription agents to handle more of the order processing. At this point, I'll digress a little bit and tell you what my best hope for Seru is, and that is that my subscription agents will find out for me all of those publishers that are registered at the Seru site, find out which of their titles are covered by Seru, and I can automatically then tell them to just sign me up. Go ahead. If I have a subscription in print and this publisher has registered with Seru, turn on the access and let me know. And I can give them a price range if there's an extra charge. But that will be the best of all possible worlds for me to outsource this whole time center of trying to track down what the license is, if there's a license, and how to get access. As I mentioned at the outset, Seru is probably not going to be implemented for every single publisher and library interaction where there is currently a license. But if the library and the publisher both agree that copyright law can suffice, then Seru is appropriate. The other condition, of course, is that Seru accurately reflects the shared understanding of both the individual publisher and library. And you do have that understanding in your handouts. I would invite you to take a look at it. Not right now. When you might want a license, when there's a multi-year contract, maybe there are just too many complexities and a contract would be more appropriate than going just relying on copyright law. When there's an unusual or very complex business model or a very expensive resource, perhaps a library wouldn't feel comfortable with just a purchase order. I don't know. In the print world, we've paid some pretty big bucks for some pretty expensive resources and felt comfortable relying on copyright. I think there is, though, a reason why a license might be appropriate in some cases, and that's because in a digital environment, libraries so seldom have possession of the content. And so if it's served remotely, there may be good reason why a library and a publisher would feel more comfortable. Also, a complex consortial arrangement, the consortial partners may want to have a contract just to establish their relationships to each other as well as to the publisher. I will say that BioOne, we have consortially, and they have used Seru. So for those of you who have BioOne subscriptions, we had a license for BioOne because that predated Seru, but for BioOne too, we use Seru, and you can too. How did Seru start? I debated whether or not to include these slides because by now Seru is beyond the initial phase. It's out of pilot and it has been adopted by NISO as a best practice. But it might be somewhat instructive to go back over its history. It really wasn't all that long ago. Judy Luther and I met at a conference at an ALA and were complaining from the library side, that was me, and from the publisher side, that was Judy Luther, who is an independent consultant and had a couple of clients who were small publishers, about how extraordinarily difficult it was to get beyond the license and how much that just slowed the entire process if it didn't stop it completely. And Judy and I batted around an idea of how to get around the license, the difficulties in licensing. We talked about some kind of a best practice, and we took this question on the road to a number of conferences that followed, Charleston, Midwinter, the ERNL conference. I don't know if any of you have attended that. Yeah, great conference. And ALA Summer. And from the response we got back from publishers from libraries, there seemed to be an intuitive understanding that licensing may not be the best way to go, that we may be at a point now, 10 years plus, after electronic resources started to take off, where there could be some kind of consensus about what constituted say, an authorized user, what constituted a site, and what kind of behavior we could expect from each other, publishers and libraries. During these conferences, we polled the audience about their experiences in licensing. Many had a backlog of licenses, and some noted that a few publishers didn't have license agreements, and they were perfectly comfortable going with copyright law. Publishers, surprising to me as a librarian, thought that most libraries required a license. Is that your understanding? Do any of your institutions require that you have a license? Yeah. When the publisher does not offer you a license, do you have a license that you then give the publisher to sign? You have to have something in writing. This is not true of print, microfilm. Yeah, that's interesting. Do they ever accept a statement that says copyright law applies? I have wondered. I have heard of the odd library that does require a license, and I was never sure exactly how that played out practically with the practices. I wonder if that's a holdover from software. Yeah. Interestingly, Linda Beebe from the American Psychological Association said that that's where their notion of licensing came from. They saw that software providers had a license. When they first got into putting their materials online, they thought, oh, well, if you're going to be online, you need a license. I do think that in the 10 years experience that libraries and publishers have, we have exhibited the same level of trust that we had in the print environment. Libraries tend to be not only service-oriented, but very conscientious. And I think there is a level of trust that we can build on. Let's see. Everyone did want relief. What Judy and I then did was talk to two publishing organizations and two library organizations. I can never remember what the initials stand for. So ARL is the Association of Research Libraries. SPARC is the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resource Coalition. They were very supportive. Also ALPS, the Association of Learned and Professional Society Publishers, and SSP, the Society for Scholarly Publishing, which Judy was the incoming president of back in 2005. We also contacted a couple of lawyers to make sure that we weren't creating another license, and a couple of other librarians from different sized institutions, from a medium-sized library, from a smaller academic library, but all were, I have to emphasize, from academic libraries. And on the publisher side, we contacted large commercial publishers, scholarly publishers, and university presses. We created a preliminary draft. We hashed it out at the ARL headquarters in October of 2006. We talked about all the things that we thought people needed protection from that a license could offer. What were the risks for publishers? What were the risks for libraries? And then we looked at whether or not these were satisfied by licenses. Eventually, NISO adopted the working group in December. We were very glad for their sponsorship. We had another series of meetings. NISO set up our very first CERU draft in March of 2007. The pilot project draft was opened up in the summer of 2007. I see the slide is a little out of date. The pilot project is over, and we have been accepted. Again, the supporting organizations without which we could not have met and created the initial draft, and a list of the working group members. You can see that they came from a lot of different sized libraries, different sized publishers. We also had the help of Oliver Pesch from EBSCO Subscription Agents, who was very instrumental in getting our contact at NYSO. Just a really incredible experience for me to see how collaboration could come together and in a relatively short time come out with something that really does look to me like a solution. So what did we do when we met? We looked at the risks that libraries took, that publishers took, and we decided, after examining publishers' responses and library responses in this group, that really the license didn't protect very much. And I think that's primarily because, what you're no doubt all aware of, the biggest risk to publishers comes from the end user, not from libraries. And the licenses, of course, are between the librarians and the publishers, and no librarian is going to assume the risk or responsibility for behavior of the end user. So what we did was look at a license. We separated it into what we thought were three natural parts, and the first part was the definitions. The other was contract boilerplate, things like force majeure, governing law, and the other was the purchase information or the business model kind of things, how many simultaneous users, for example, what it was you were purchasing. Some of the common elements that we defined or that were defined in a license were things like subscriptions and subscribers, appropriate, what's inappropriate use, what about confidentiality and privacy, what are our expectations for that, what are our expectations for online performance and service, and what are our expectations for archival access and perpetual rights. The things that weren't definitions, we just ejected. And what we were missing in CERU are things like jurisdictions, warranties, liabilities, force majeures, assignments, and servability clauses, all those things that you read, those of you who read licenses, read sort of propping up your eyelids as you go through the tiny print. And the business terms, what content, what cost, for how long, and for how many, we suggested that those be moved back to the purchase order. So how would CERU work? Well, the idea is that it's voluntary, but that if you register, then the world knows that you support the particular definitions, the consensus, the articulation of consensus on behavior for electronic resources. So a publisher would forego a license and rely on the shared understandings, as with the library. The purchase order would become the acquisition vehicle. There could then be greater opportunity to place the orders through subscription agents or consortium. CERU is posted at the NYSO website, and there is the ability for libraries and publishers to register. Can I ask how many are registered at the moment? Great, and I'm so glad I'm here. You will notice in your handout that Karen Wetzel's email address is there in tiny print, probably on the second-to-last slide. That handout, in fact, is the condensed slideshow. I only wanted to use two pages, so a lot of the middle part is missing. But the important part is Karen's email address. I would invite you to go look at the NYSO site, but not any time in the near future because it's under construction and you can't get there. I am sorry to report. Where are we now? Well, I think I probably let the cat out of the bag. We did have a formal NYSO review after the pilot project ended. It was completed last December. We were voted a best practice in February, and we now have the CERU version 1.0 up on the website. Oh, here's Karen's email address. Great, make a note of that. At the moment, there are approximately twice as many libraries as publishers registered at the website. And there are four consortia. So there are 19 publishers. That was the last time I was able to get to the site, and 39 libraries. Obviously, for this to work, it requires the participation of many publishers and many libraries. But I have to say that I am thrilled that there are even that many as there are, as many as there are. This is really a very new concept, and it's a very, very new project, best practice. I am hoping that publishers will be encouraged, especially the small publishers, to sign on. One of our strategies is to see if we can get the support of some of the larger publishers. I know that I have been in conversation with some of the big humanities, social sciences publishers, the same ones who tend to support Locke's and Portico. My own library has about 30 titles that are based on Seru. I'm getting ready to set up another database, which is a little surprising to me. I had imagined this would be best suited for e-journals, but there has been interest in publishers to do databases as well. And now it's your turn. Questions? Yes. I think that's a really wonderful question. I don't know if everyone heard it, but the question was that she had always thought of copyright as being appropriate for things that you own, and that the license would be for things that you lease. It's I have to say that in the electronic environment, one of the biggest things that changes what a library does and how a library relates to the things that it subscribes to is the fact that it doesn't have physical possession of them in the same way they physically possess microfilm and videos and print materials. Some licenses are about lease only. You're big indexing and abstracting databases, for instance. And that's why I think it's difficult to see how Seru could... it's not impossible, but it doesn't seem to me as good a model for those leased materials. For the electronic journals, though, one of the things that Seru promotes, of course, is the notion of perpetual access. And so we subscribe to content in digital form, in print form. Libraries' expectations, although not always realized, is that we would have perpetual access to the digital copy. Where this might break down a little bit is that there haven't been good guarantees for that until the last few years. Portico is pretty new. Locke's is a little older, but still getting its feet wet, getting off the ground. I know many of my licenses would say things like we would be entitled to a digital copy, either a CD-ROM or some tape. But the truth is that libraries aren't really prepared to start hosting their digital content by and large. Now you can flip to, now you can look at your handouts and flip to the part in the Seru document that talks about archival and perpetual access. And what we're recommending there is the best of all possible worlds in that there is an understanding that perpetual access is a good thing and ought to be granted libraries who subscribe for the period to which they have subscribed. But there is no specification of how that's going to be guaranteed. Your larger question, I had never framed it quite that way, but libraries have always had sort of a unique relationship with copyrighted material, and that's where the fair use provisions were included in copyright law. What Seru does, in my mind, is supplement copyright law in much the same way that the CONTU guidelines augment the ILL provisions. Seru doesn't specify numbers, but Seru does sort of give articulations to consensus views. just as copyright law talked about a reasonable number of requests fulfilling, a library can fulfill a reasonable number. The CONTU guideline says, okay, we're pretty sure that a reasonable number is 5. And that made it possible, even though the CONTU guidelines were never ratified, it made it possible for libraries and publishers to feel comfortable with each other. CERU is not quite that specific, but it does set out a definition that was culled from many, many licenses and seemed to represent pretty much a shared understanding. I will confess that it's been very difficult, especially at first, for me to talk about CERU and avoid the word agreement or anything that smacks of a license, because I am so used to thinking in terms of the license as the terms of use. It was rather comic to sit around that first meeting of the CERU working group and listen to people try and grapple with how you would express what an authorized user is and not use words like shall or have the right to. All the things that come to librarians and publishers from the framework of contract language. I don't know if that really satisfied your explanation, but here's my fallback answer to everything I can't really provide a good reason for, and that is if you're not comfortable with it, then use a license. CERU really is designed to support the trust that publishers and libraries have. And copyright law has sustained us for generations. The digital environment does have many differences. CERU hopes to be able to articulate what the expectations should be given those differences. One of the problems that contracts have, even contracts that from publishers who don't want to, rewrite copyright law. But in a contract, because it trumps copyright law, publishers will sometimes go to extreme lengths to try and describe what your rights are in fair use. They aren't comfortable saying fair use applies or nothing in this license in any way limits the fair use provisions, although some contracts do explicitly say that. More often, my experience is that there will be an ILL clause with language that tries to describe fair use. The problem is that it's hard to describe. And so there are questions. I don't know if you all have questions. Can you use Arial? What does this mean in my context? Kind of lost the thread of your question. I'm sorry. I went off on a little bit of a tangent. CERU wants us to rely on copyright law. Now, very often in a license, it will, I don't know if you've noticed, provisions that aren't expressly permitted are denied. And that means that even if they're silent on something that's allowed in copyright law, you can't rely on that to be the prevailing law because it hasn't been expressly, articulated in the license. I am not a lawyer. That's probably obvious, and that's why we brought lawyers in to the conversation. There are such things as contracts of adhesions, about which I have a rather ephemeral understanding, but we worked very hard not to be a different kind of contract. What we really intended to be with CERU is a supplement to copyright law that describes those things that are never discussed in copyright law because it was conceived before online content was so prevalent. The question was, would I recommend you go and sign up even though there aren't any publishers on that site that you do business with? Yes. And I think it's a show of support. I think it's a way we can point to publishers and say libraries do support this. And if you sign on to CERU, there is a likelihood that it will be utilized. Right now, Duke University Press is there. I think the APA is there now publishing Bio1. The very first publisher that showed up as a registration, or that registered that I could do anything with was the, oh,
how can I forget? Maybe the National Geological Society of the UK. That's not quite it. The Geological Society Publishing House. And I had 5 print titles that weren't online. And I was thrilled when I was able to write to them and say, can I use Seru? And they were back and said, yes, of course. And so it was, you know, the next day I had access. My hope is that we can go to platform providers that work with the small publishers like Highwire and Ingenta, Metapress, and maybe through them help promote the idea. This hasn't been around all that long, just about a year, and it's pilot, and now it's accepted NISO best practice phase. When I looked last month, there were 19 publishers, 39 libraries, 4 consortia. And TRLN, my local consortium, was one of the first to register, and almost instantly we did the Bio 1-2 serum. A publisher had asked, how were they supposed to indicate that they had registered with Seru? And as far as I'm concerned, an email suffices for my institution, it might not for yours. This can go on a purchase order or an invoice. I don't always get a purchase order, but I always get an invoice. So, hopefully. So Seru can go on the invoice. It doesn't much matter. It's just pretty much up to the institutions. Other questions? Yeah, Gail. Gail's question was, did I have to get my purchasing people to understand about Seru? And I have to say, it's not an easy concept to get. It is now for me because I've been living it for 2 years, 2.5. But there hasn't been this other category of things. There's copyright law, there's contract law, and now there's Seru, which isn't either. I try and talk to people about Seru as if it's a complement to copyright law. But to answer Gail's questions, I didn't have to because the library is empowered to handle all of that ourselves. And I know that is not the case with others of you. Yeah. I think that's also why it helps to be NISO, associated with NISO. ISO is nationally recognized, and publishers who do register there are doing that publicly. If I had to make the argument to my purchasing department, I would say we have been fine with copyright law for years and years. I will say one more thing. I don't know how many of you are also participating in LOCS. Yeah. I like LOCS a lot because it is library-centric. It's not true of other third-party, even trusted third-party providers. But it's a perpetual access guarantor that the libraries have the potential to control in ways that we don't control, say, Portico or the National Library of the Netherlands. Both very necessary and wonderful, providers of perpetual access and archives, but LOCS appeals to me because it is library-centric. I think Seru and LOCS together for small publishers would be a wonderful combination, and that to me would complete the circle because one of the most difficult things for a publisher to provide is perpetual access. They have perpetual expenses if they are the ones who host. So. That sounds like a sign to me. I want to thank you very much for being a good audience. Please do take materials home. I don't know when you'll be able to get to the NISO site, but Karen has assured me that if you email her, she will put your information up there. Thank you very much.